Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to Nightlight, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We're so glad that you could spend time with us here. I want to first thank Ken Quiet Hawk for his amazing introduction. Please check out him on the internet. Look for Native Storytellers, and his name will probably be right on the top. He and his wife have spent their lifetime being Native Storytellers and preserving history in a very unique and unusual way that has been used for generations before the printed word, which in many ways puts greater life into the history rather than dry books. Only my opinion. I have tonight with me Jim Willis, who has written a fascinating book called Censoring God, The History of the Lost Books. And I found it fascinating. I enjoyed reading it, and I'm probably going to go back and read it a couple more times, giving me a further insight into a lot of the material here. It opened questions for me, and it gave me answers, and it's just an exciting book. And here's a little bit about it. Why isn't the Book of Enoch in the Holy Bible, even though Enoch is referenced multiple times? Why were texts considered sacred by many, excluded by others? And who made the decisions and why? There are more than 50 books, some of which exist only in fragments, while others are complete and whole, that are not included in the Bible canon. Why were these discarded? Most Protestant denominations settled on 66 canonical books of the Bible, while there are 73 for Roman Catholics and 78 for Eastern Orthodox adherents. And why are there these differences of opinion? We're often taught that the Bible is, in the words of many religious catechisms, the infallible word of faith and practice. In reality, the Bible can also be seen as a political document as much as a spiritual one. Ordained minister and theologian Jim Willis examines the historical, political, and social climates that influenced the detractors and editors of the Bible and other sacred texts in his book, Censoring God, The History of the Lost Books and Other Excluded Scriptures. In analyzing why texts were censored, he uncovers sometimes surprising biases. He investigates enigmatic hints of Bible codes and ancient wisdom that implies a greater spiritual force might have been at work. He explores the importance of the Book of Enoch, its disappearance, and how it was rediscovered in Ethiopia. And he analyzes over 24 excluded texts, such as Jubilees and the Gospel of Thomas, along with the many references to books that we know about from fragments but remain lost. This is a really important book, and it looks at the human failings in interpreting God's words and through a compassionate examination, it brings a deeper understanding of the power and importance of the lost words. He earned his master's degree in theology from Andover Newton Theological School, and he has been an ordained minister for over 40 years. He's also taught college courses in comparative religion and cross-cultural studies. He knows a whole bunch more than all of us put together, probably, and he is here to enlighten us for sure. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. Before we even begin, I've got to say that I fully agree with you about your opening. Every time I hear that music and that wonderful, wonderful voice, I just love it. It just ties me in, brings me in. It really does. What a wonderful narrator he is. What a wonderful voice he has. I would love to sit around a fire some night with a bunch of people and listen to him tell the old stories. Wow, would that be fantastic.
Well, you know, you actually can do that. He and his wife have done a number of CDs, and they all are for sale, of course, on his website and on Amazon, I believe. And the stories are wonderful because they are telling the stories of the cosmology and the history of the Native Americans, and it's a wonderful way to learn that history. And, oh, my goodness, his voice, you're right, is just, I heard it and I said, that's my voice.
in the shamanic tradition, it was understood for years, there are even practicing shamans today who say that once you write down the words on paper, they lose their significance. It has to be an oral tradition. And I really think about that. I think about it especially today. You know, kids today, we just don't sit around as families, multi-generation families, and hear the stories of what things were like in the old days. I've had even my own grandchildren, they come to visit. And if we start talking, the next thing you know, the iPhones will be out, you know, and they'll be looking. And the whole idea of multi-generation families, 2-3 generations sometimes, sitting around a campfire at night and listening to the stories, and it's wonderful. I've had some experience with that with a Native American mentor of mine, a teaching elder from the Ojibwe tribe. And he came, he would come out to New England a couple of times a year. And he was able to share, for instance, his tribe's creation story, which normally takes like, 4 or 5 days to tell. But he was allowed to give us the shortened version, which though we just spent a day. I've never had a day go by so quickly. It was just amazing to hear the power and the vibration of the story and just get lost in it. And as soon as you write it down, you start thinking about, well, this couldn't be because, we have to compare this with the history that we know. And all this kind of, it just loses so much power. So I'm going to look up his website, and I'm going to look into that. I really am.
Well, they say that words don't begin to live until they're spoken.
I think so. Yeah, I agree. 100%.
Maybe we should do the Bible that way.
Well, I think so. I have listened to the Bible on, just the spoken word, audio books. And to be honest, mostly I find it kind of dull, but I don't think it's because of the words. I think it's because of the readers. They're reading words. And when you listen to an oral tradition of an elder who's just telling a story, he's not reading anything. He's using his own words. And so it might change a little bit from here to there. But that's fine, So I'm just not sure. I go back and forth on that. I'm not sure a real oral tradition involves reading any words off a page. You know what I mean?
Well, no, probably it doesn't. But isn't that the way that the Bible stories originally were passed
that's
around?
That's the way they were at first. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's why we have so many strange things that we can't explain, especially about the old texts, the Genesis text, for instance. There's a lot of things in there that we just can't explain. And I think it's probably because the texts, the stories were so well known that when they were written down, probably all of the inflections and everything else went in. For instance, you know, Genesis 6, there were giants in the on the earth in those days. Well, what does that mean? In the Bible, there's no context given, you know. The book of Enoch gives a lot more context, but in the Bible, there is no context. It's just, and I can just imagine the thrill that would have gone down my spine if I had been sitting in the dark looking at a fire, hearing a teaching elder say, and there were giants in the land in those days. Wow, that would have just absolutely blown me away.
but you know, when you stop to think about it, every storyteller enhances or changes things slightly, and then a lot of these texts were copied and copied and copied and copied, and some of them were dictated, and quite possibly the person dictating was saying one thing, and the person dicking it down was saying, "Well, I can put that a better way," and you know, just
as a matter of, you know, there is an actual example of that when Jerome. St. Jerome, I can't remember the date now. I think it must have been 405 CE, 405 of the Common Era, or 405 years after the traditional birth of Jesus. He was translating, and the words, the scriptures of the New Testament, and well, for that matter, the Old Testament too, into a translation which is now called the Latin Vulgate. And it's still the official version of the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, and a lot of books of the Bible. I mean, a lot of modern translations are based on that translation. But when he was converting the words of Paul into Latin, once in a while he would make changes because he said, "Well, we can't expect Paul to use the same quality of Latin that we have nowadays." So he was actually admitting that he was not just translating the words of Paul in his epistles. He was actually trying to improve upon them a little bit to give a little better language.
Well, that's actually been done. Well, and there is that old story, and I'm sure you've heard it, about the monks that were in the monastery copying the texts over and over and over again. And finally one of them said to his friend, "Do we still have the originals down in the basement or in the archives?" And his friend said, "Oh, surely, go down and look." And he goes down and looks, and the guy never comes back up. And finally the supervisor goes down and finds him just sobbing over the desk, and he says, "What's wrong?" And he looks up with tears streaming down his face, and he said it was celebrate, not celibate.
Oh, I haven't heard that story. I'm going to use it, though. I'm going to steal it from you, Barbara. I love it.
Yeah, enhance it all you want.
There you go. There you go.
The tagline is just precious. So we're looking at Old Testament and New Testament, and we're looking at all of these books that supposedly were written by the disciples and by, other people. And one of the biggest aha moments that I have ever had is that most of the books written by, theoretically, the disciples were not written by the disciples.
Yeah. It comes as a shock to most people. I know it came to shock to me when I first went to seminary and started studying this stuff. We like to think about the Bible being straight from the Word of God, right from the mouth of God. You know, God dictated the Bible, and now we have it just as God wants us to. But when you start to look at, all the catechisms, the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Roman Catholics, they all have it in their catechism that the Bible is the only infallible rule of faith and practice. And it comes as a shock, and it almost seems like heresy to a lot of Christians who have Bibles in their homes, and they swear by the Bible, they swear on the Bible, once in a while they swear at the Bible, who say, this is the Word of God. They've never read it. And so they just imagine what's in there, and they think they're getting it from, you know, if they hear it from the pulpits or something like that, and they think that this is what's in the Word of God. And it comes as a shock for them to realize we don't have one, not one, original text of both the New Testament or the Old Testament. Not one original text survives, of course. I was born in 1946, and the year before I was born, the Nag Hammadi texts were discovered in Egypt. And what the Nag Hammadi texts are was what in Egypt, primarily the church in Egypt for the first couple hundred years was what we now call the Gnostic tradition church. The Gnostics were there, and they had all kinds of the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Bartholomew and all of these Gospels that were considered Gnostic Gospels. Probably the most famous nowadays is the Gospel of Thomas. And the Roman Church was in Western Europe, and the Eastern Orthodox, what we now call the Eastern Orthodox Church, was in Asia, and Istanbul was right in the center of them both. Istanbul used to be Constantinople, and that's where Constantine moved the capital of Rome. It moved his own capital. So we had three different churches going on. And the Constantine wanted to bring together the Roman Empire, and he decided to do it with religion in the 4th century. And so when he wanted to get together one world religion, they had to decide, well, which one are you going to do, the Gnostic tradition, the Roman tradition, or the Orthodox tradition? And the Roman tradition won out. And so the decree went out from Rome that the Gnostics had to get rid of all their texts. They had to burn them all because they didn't necessarily agree with the books that were going to be what we now call the New Testament. So they were just destroyed wholesale. They were burned all over the place. But some far-seeing Gnostic priests decided, no, it's not going to happen. And they took their Gospels. And they buried them in clay jars, and they buried them in the desert. And there they sat. Nobody knew they were there until the year 1945 when they were discovered. And in 1945, we got all of a sudden all these new texts. The same kind of thing happened to what we Christians call the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures. All these texts were buried up in around the Dead Sea, and they're now called the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were born in were discovered in 1947, but neither the Nag Hammadi texts or the Dead Sea Scrolls, they didn't have any originals either. They were copies of copies of copies. So I think it was kind of destiny for me to be born in 1946, the year before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the year after the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Scrolls. I think I was just kind of destined in my life to look into all these things and discover them. So when I wrote Censoring God, it's the 13th book that I've written now since 2001, but in a way it's my favorite because I've been studying it my whole life, literally my whole life. I was one of those obnoxious Sunday school kids who used to raise questions all the time and got yelled at in Sunday school. So I guess I've been studying the scriptures since 1950 anyway, and seriously studying them since about 1970, I guess. It's been a trip. I want to tell you, when I wrote Censoring God, it was kind of like put my whole lifetime of my study into it.
Well, yeah, but I think most people don't understand that it isn't the book itself is not written as an ongoing storyline. They were putting essays together to create a storyline.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing I think for people to come to grips with. That between us and all those original texts, there stands a committee, always a committee, In the Old Testament, for instance, the Hebrew Scriptures, most people like to think of Jesus having the Bible in his hands because the Old Testament was all written before Jesus, they say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true. What we call the Old Testament really wasn't put together until, well, tradition has it, at the Council of Jamnia, which was the late 1st century CE. After about 100 years after Jesus, 94 years after the birth of Jesus, ostensibly. Of course, there's all kinds of questions about that, but it was put together 100 years after Jesus, or certainly after Jesus. So he never held in his hands a document that we call the Old Testament. Now, that's not to say he didn't have scriptures in his hands that we can recognize today, but every synagogue, every group of Jews in each town, every group of elders would have different copies. They would have different books of the Bible. I mean, sometimes they would exchange them back and forth. If somebody had only half of Isaiah, maybe they would keep it for a year and then exchange it with the next town over, which had the second half of Isaiah or something like that. So in terms of the New Testament, well, that wasn't put together until like 400 years after the birth of Christ. And it really makes me wonder about those committees that sat there, because, boy, if you gave me a chance to go back in history and sit in on anything, I would love to go back to Jamnia, or I would like to go back to Hippo or Carthage and peek in the wastebaskets and see what they threw away. and the problem is that we know that the committees felt a lot of guilt about what they were doing, because they just didn't include some books and put the others aside. They included the books they wanted included, and they burned the rest. They destroyed the rest. And all we have is fragments of them here and there, fragments of this book or a fragment of that book that we've discovered in different places. What gets me is, why would they burn texts that they didn't want in the Bible unless they were trying to cover up their work? They wanted to make sure that we didn't have the ability to go back and check on them. So they must have had an ulterior motive. It was the same kind of thing that happened when the Spanish went into Central America, and when they were overcoming the Mayans, and they had all these wonderful Mayan scriptures, and the Spanish grew in, and they didn't want anybody to see this. They wanted to censor them. So what did they do? They gathered them all together, and they burned them in the public square. They said they were of the devil. We're going to burn them. And the only reason we know about the Mayan scriptures today, the Popol Vuh or some of those other Mayan scriptures, is because some far-seeing Spanish priests had the foresight to make Spanish translations of them, and they would show up in different parts of the world. If it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have even known the Mayans had a written language. It's a terrible, terrible thing, but that's why I called the book Censoring God, because that's exactly what these people were trying to do.
So they took these texts, and the author was never whose name appears on it.
Yeah. Take the first five books of the Bible, for instance.
Okay.
Sometimes in Protestant Bibles, they're called the books of Moses because they were supposedly written by Moses. Well, of course, they weren't. Some people in the Jewish tradition, they call them the books of Moses, but in the Christian tradition, sometimes we call it the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible. And if you start with Genesis and read one right through, it seems to be one continuous story. But there's almost no question today that it was written by at least four different authors. It's called the J-E-P-D theory, because they had four different names for God and they had four different writing styles. The J author refers to J in Germany, where these ideas first came out. The word Yahweh is used. It's the Hebrew word Yahweh, and sometimes in Bible in English it's translated either as the Lord or as Jehovah. And so, because the word Jehovah is there, they refer to the J author, who refers to God as Jehovah. And then there's the E doctrine, who refers to God as Elohim. And so he's the E author. And the P and D stand for, you know, two different authors, and so it's the JEPD theory. And it's at least four different authors. And what they did was they would take all the different texts they had and try to stitch the committee, stitch them together, because these authors lived centuries apart from each other. They certainly didn't know each other. And they would stitch them together in one continuous thread from Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So in the English Bible, you pick it up and read it, or even in the Latin Vulgate, and it appears to be just one, you know, one narrative, one story. Four different stories stitched together in different ways. And that's why there are some discrepancies among them, some things that they just couldn't hide, because one author said something that somebody else disagreed with. If you want to see this, all you have to do is take the Bible off your shelf, anybody who's listening, and read the first two chapters of Genesis, Genesis 1 and 2. They are two completely different accounts of creation. And yet we read them so often that we think, well, it's just one story. But read them carefully and you see that they're two totally different books, two totally different versions of the same story.
Well, and not only that, but they seem to be borrowing from ancient mythology and other legends,
yes,
too, to create a story with a, they created a flow, and
yeah,
and mm-hmm, to, and Isaiah, who was Isaiah? Did Isaiah,
yeah,
didn't write Isaiah? I mean,
yeah,
why?
Yeah,
why
Isaiah.
Did they...
There are at least two different authors who wrote Isaiah, and maybe three. Yeah.
So, but you know, that I have to jump ahead to the New Testament. So, but Paul wrote Paul, right or wrong? Paul wrote, you know, the letters to the Corinthians and stuff like that. I mean,
he may have written some of them. Yeah, he wrote some of them, but some of them are almost certainly not written by the Apostle Paul. 2 Timothy, Titus, other, you know, the book of Colossians, probably the book of Ephesians, those were almost certainly not written by the Apostle Paul. They were probably written by, it's just pure speculation, but the idea is people want to try to say, well, it was written by a disciple of the Apostle Paul who wanted to put his name on it because he was inspired by Paul and he wanted to give Paul the honor, you know, of it. But Paul wrote some letters which were original to him, 1 Corinthians probably, and Romans, and a couple of others. But almost certainly he didn't write all of them, and his name is on them, but he didn't write them.
What about the Songs of Solomon? Did Solomon actually write that poetry, or?
Almost certainly not.
Oh.
That's a fantastic, I mean, it's a beautiful poem. If a lot of people have not read the Book of Solomon, but if you want to do it, I really would recommend it, because it's a very, well, and sometimes very graphic, I don't want to say pornographic, but a very graphic love poem that talks very candidly about sexual love between Solomon and one of his wives or one of his mistresses. It almost certainly was not written by Solomon, but it was dedicated to him. But there's a fascinating story about the Song of Solomon. It'll take us a little off where we were going, but people always wondered, well, okay, Solomon was the author and he was the male lover. Who was the woman? And the story is told in both Kings and in Chronicles that the Queen of Sheba came up to visit Solomon because she wanted to hear about his wisdom and his wealth and everything else. And the story is told that, well, the Queen of Sheba, you know, people say, well, where is Sheba? Probably in those times, Ethiopia and Yemen were together for about 100 years during the time of Solomon. And at that time, they were one country and ruled by one queen. And she has different names, the story that the Ethiopians still tell the story today is that the Queen of Sheba went up to see Solomon, and she was very taken with him. And there's a funny story about Solomon was taken with her as well. And the story goes that this isn't in the Bible. This is from extra biblical stuff. But the story is said that Solomon said to the Queen of Sheba that he wanted her to stay in the castle. And she said, well, I'll stay in the castle with you as long as you don't make any sexual advances toward me. And he said, okay, I'll agree to that as long as you don't take anything that's mine. And she says, okay, I won't steal anything that's yours. So she had dinner with Solomon. And Solomon, being a crafty old guy, decided to serve this very hot, spicy dinner, which she really loved. But it made her very thirsty, and he put a pitcher of water by her bed. And when she woke up in the night, she was very thirsty after this thing. So she took a glass of water. Solomon came right in and said, you just stole something from me. You stole the water that I put by your bed. Therefore, we're going to sleep together the rest of the
can't
night.
Can't move over.
And the story is that when Sheba went back, and the Bible does tell this story, that Sheba went back and said Solomon was just the greatest thing she'd ever seen. When she went back to Ethiopia, she took with her more than just the presents that Solomon gave. She actually took Solomon's child, who became the head of Ethiopia, and even in the time of Haile Selassie, when you and I were younger, Haile Selassie called himself the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. And to this day, a lot of Ethiopians believe that they are descended from Solomon through the Queen of Sheba. But the neat thing about this whole thing is, in the Song of Solomon, when Solomon is talking about this lover who he is obviously smitten with, the lover says to him, I am black but comely. So obviously Solomon's love interest was black. Well, who would that have been? Well, the Queen of Sheba came from Ethiopia. So that's the story that possibly that connects Ethiopia. Matter of fact, the story even gets more convoluted if you want to get into it, because the story also goes, and it's to this day, they believe that the offspring of Solomon and Sheba went back to meet his father and came back to Ethiopia carrying with him the Ark of the Covenant, which many Ethiopians believe to this day is still housed in a temple in Ethiopia. So it gets very convoluted.
You know, and it boggles my mind. I know that the priest that watches over it is solitary, and he's there for his entire life, and he never leaves the compound, and he never talks to people.
And they have an amazingly short lifespan, too. What do they die of? You know, people wonder whether it's radiation coming from the Ark of the Covenant, which they believe, reading in the Old Testament, was some kind of a... had some kind of power associated with it, either electromagnetic or even nuclear or whatever, the radiation, that takes the lives of these priests very quickly.
It boggles my mind that nobody in power has just gone in and unlocked the gate and said, look out, I'm coming in. I mean, everyone has respected the fact that they're not allowed in. It boggles my mind because...
Yeah, the Ethiopians, they want to protect that just as much as the Vatican wants to protect the stuff in the Vatican archives. You know, I mean, there are lots of secrets hidden away. And the Ethiopians themselves are not going to let it. And, of course, to come in any outsider who wants to come in is going to, first of all, have to defeat Ethiopia to see what's in there. And, you know, they're not going to go to war with Ethiopia over something like this, probably. So it's mind-boggling is a good way to put it.
It's just, you know, I've seen so many different reports on people trying to get in, and the fact that, you know, they will talk to not the main priest himself, but, you know, a helper. And, I mean, what a lonely life.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, what an awesome job.
What is in there? It's amazing. It's amazing. But to this day, if you read any of the books out there or articles published about where is the Ark of the Covenant today, because it disappeared in the Old Testament, the book of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, it disappeared, and nobody knows where it is. And there's all kinds of ideas. Some people believe it was buried in the underneath the temple, when the temple was destroyed in 586 BC by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. Some people believe it was buried there. Some people believe the Knights Templar found it and took it to Oak Island, you know, in Canada. Some people believe it. There's one wild story that it's in hidden away in a cave in the Grand Canyon. All kinds of ideas. And some
also
people believe
Montana.
Montana. That's right. All over the place. It's just it's crazy. So who knows?
When you stop to think about it, the Ark of the Covenant was made of wood overlaid with gold.
Yeah.
What wood lasts over 2,000 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this be, closer to 3,500 years.
Yeah,
that's right.
My personal opinion is that, you know, they did find treasure and they did find stuff. But I think they found texts, they found, you know, scrolls, they found wisdom for sure.
Yeah.
But as far as the Ark of the Covenant,
well,
I don't know.
There's another, if we have time to go into this, there's another fascinating story about the Ark of the Covenant. And that's that do we have time to go into the whole story? Does
sure.
It get too far off the track?
I was trying to work
this out ever since I was in Egypt over there looking at the pyramid complex in Giza. And, of course, when you go down into the pyramids with a small group like ours, you just can't go down by yourself. You have to have an official Egypt guide with you. And the Egyptologists over there who give you the official party line follow the line that Egypt is called. The pyramids are called tombs and tombs only. They were just written for tombs. And other people think that maybe there's all kinds of other reasons that the pyramids were built. But when our small group was going down studying the pyramids, and we went in down in the pyramid with this Egyptologist guide, we were walking down this wooden pathway, and I noticed there were these wires running alongside of the pathway. And the purpose of the wires was to power the lights, which would go on ahead of us as we went down. And I began to think, well, how did they see to work down here? When there were no, they didn't have electric wires and electric, you know. So I was the first one in line. So I asked the guide. I looked up at the ceiling and I looked at the walls, looking for signs of soot, you know, from torches or something like that. And I said, "How did they see to get down here?" And the guide, he literally turned away from me and said, "Oh, they must have had some kind of a light source," and on he walked. Well. That story got me thinking about how did they see down there? And when I began to read the stories about the Ark of the Covenant, I got this crazy idea, which I doubt is really true, but I'll just put it out there because who knows. I've heard other people say it since, that, you know, the Ark of the Covenant itself seems to be associated with a great power source, because when Moses went into the tent, nobody was allowed to look at the Ark of the Covenant. Matter of fact, the only people who did touch it, they died right away. They hit with all, you know, they just fell over and died. The Lord smote them, as it were, and who knows what it was, but it seems to be some kind of great power source. And so the question was, could it have been, this is really wild, but could it have been that the Ark of the Covenant was one of a type of a battery, a generator, a capacitor of some kind that actually had the ability to power so they could actually get lights down in the pyramid. Well, that would explain why when Moses fled, you know, Egypt, when he said to the people, "Let my people go," and they went out into the desert, and it said there they built the Ark of the Covenant. But what if they took the Ark of the Covenant with them? That would explain why Pharaoh said, "Okay, yeah, after the 10 plagues, get out of here, go, you know, beat it." And the Exodus took place. Moses led the people of Israel, you know, through the parted Red Sea waters, and they went out into the Sinai and headed for Israel. But then the Pharaoh changed his mind, and he got his army together to went out and chased after Moses. And they said, well, what made Pharaoh change his mind? And some people began to say, well, could it have been that he realized that when Moses went off with the people, he didn't just go off by himself, but he took the Ark of the Covenant, which was the power source for the pyramids. And he changed his mind. He went out there, and, of course, the Red Sea waters, which parted for Moses, came back together again and flooded out Pharaoh and all of his army. And then the story in Exodus goes to say, well, then they went and built the Ark of the Covenant out there in the desert. But what if he actually took it with him in the first place? And what if it was some kind of a power source? And they took it with him, and they did keep it in a tent. And then they did build a whole temple for it. And then somehow it was taken down to Ethiopia, where it stands today, which explains why the priests who guard it have such a short life, because they're in touch with this fantastic power source that, it's a crazy story, but I love stories like that. I just really love them.
Not really, because if you look at some of the hieroglyphs in some of the temples, you will see there is at least one hieroglyph, and it appears that they have an electric light bulb.
Yeah, and what's up with that? It works. It's an interesting thought, isn't it? That because otherwise, when you stop to think about it, the whole story is so fantastic that you read about it in the Bible, you find yourself saying, why is this included in the Bible? What does it mean? And so we start to look for all kinds of symbolic meanings and symbolic reasons for it being there. But the whole story is so fantastic. What if what we have in the Bible is a kind of a garbled version over centuries and centuries of this story being told over and over again orally? What if what we have in the Bible is actually a garbled version of an actual historical event? It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, since people are relying upon the Bible to be their history book, which is, in my mind, not quite appropriate, but it is interesting. It's an interesting philosophy, and I think it does bear a great deal of credence, because the Nile River used to come up almost to the Great Pyramid. That is frequently, they've said that it was really a power station.
Yeah,
and that it generated power. And there were never any mummies found in any of those pyramids.
Yeah.
So they weren't burial places.
Well, you wouldn't think so. And they say, well, the reason the mummies aren't there was because grave robbers came in and stole them. Well, boy, that's pretty speculative. If a grave robber wants to get in there, I can see him taking the treasure, but why would he take the body, That's crazy.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. There's never been one mummy discovered in one pyramid. So,
not only that, but in the Great Pyramid, there are no hieroglyphs on the walls anywhere to tell the story of Khufu, who's supposed to be buried there but isn't.
Yeah.
So.
And they also say that it was Khufu's countenance which was on what we now call the Sphinx, which was the head of the Pharaoh and the lion's body. Which sounds, and they say it was built at the same time as the Great Pyramid of Khufu, but I just cannot believe that. I think Robert Schock has proven pretty well that because of the water erosion on the bedrock underneath the Sphinx, there's no question about it that the Sphinx was built at a time when there were great rains in Egypt, and there haven't been great rains in Egypt for 11,000 years. So I think probably the Great Sphinx was, it may have been changed so that the face of the lion was edited, so to speak, and made into an image of Khufu. But I just don't. If you're going to build a pyramid that big, why do you have to build an image of yourself with a lion's body too? It's too much information.
The Egyptians were so meticulous about balance and proportion and everything else. You cannot tell me that they built this huge body and then this teeny head. It had to have at one time had a lion's head on it.
Yeah.
Had to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And it's especially interesting that the lion's head faces east, and at precisely the time when this water erosion would have taken place 10, 12,000 years ago, that was precisely the time when the constellation of Leo, the lion, would have appeared directly in the east, and the lion would have been staring right at his own image in the sky. And the last time that happened was exactly the same time, 10, 12,000 years ago, when this water erosion was supposed to have taken place. It all fits
wow.
together too beautifully. And even the Egyptians, they have this wonderful time that they call the Zeptepi. And in the Zeptepi means the first time, the early time, the beginning times. And the story is that the Egypt culture had never developed. It was basically just people living hand-to-mouth, day-to-day, you know, hunter-gatherer type situations. But these people came in, these godlike people came in on their ships from the east, and they taught them the nature of civilization itself. And when they say, when did that happen? They said, well, it happened 10 to 12,000 years ago, exactly the same time that Leo would have been looking at his constellation, his image in the skies, exactly the same time when there was water falling in the Sahara, which was not a desert then, but almost like a savanna with forest and everything else on it, all at that same time. And so, of course, you have to ask your question, well, who were these godlike people who arrived on great ships from the east? And that brings up the story of, for instance, Atlantis, because that's exactly the time that Plato puts the story of Atlantis, exactly 10,000, you know, 800 years ago. And these godlike people who came from the east with great civilized skills to teach these skills to the Egyptians in the Zeptepi, it all fits together. And there's too much coincidence.
That and the fact that I truly believe that these gods that came from the east were giants. And I do believe that a lot of those statues are lifelike statues that are so huge.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, in the Bible, we mentioned this a little while ago, in Genesis 6, it says there were giants in the earth in those days. And you say, well, how did the giants get there? Well, the Bible gives a very enigmatic story of how these giants called the Nephilim were the offspring of mating between the sons of God and the daughters of men. The Bible says the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair and came and mated with them. And their offspring were these mighty men of renown called the Nephilim or the giants. Now, the interesting thing about that is for a couple of reasons. First of all, you have to ask, well, who were the sons of God? And generally speaking, they say, well, those are fallen angels. Well, how's an angel going to mate with a human woman? You know, material, non-corporeal, it doesn't work. But what if they were real people from a lost civilization? And they were called sons of God because to these primitive people who were in Egypt at the time or around the rest of the world, the hunter-gatherers who were around the rest of the world, at this very time, you know, they were the ones that perhaps were the beneficiaries of the wisdom of this lost civilization. And as often happens when you get two different species of people, you know, mating, and the offspring are totally different. The word Nephilim, which refers to giants, is an interesting word because it's used two other times in the Old Testament, too. First of all, when David goes to kill the giant Goliath, Goliath is called a Nephilim. And in 2 Chronicles, it says that Goliath had, or 1 Chronicles, it said that God had, that Goliath had three brothers who were also called Nephilim, who were also giants. Was there a race of giants that were around the whole world? And basically, they went extinct. I mean, why would you have David killing a Goliath and then say that Goliath had three brothers who were also giants unless it was based on some kind of kernel of truth? And so the question is, where did these people come from? Where did these sons of God come from? Well, they were probably called that because they were part of a lost civilization. And here we have to go back to Atlantis and everything else. But the fascinating thing, this is the very same time of history, 10,600 years ago, when Göbekli Tepe in Anatolia was built. For a long time, they said Egypt was first, and they said, "How do you know Egypt was the first great civilization? Because we don't see any evidence of any building, anything like Egypt." And now comes Göbekli Tepe, which predates the pyramids by 6,000 years.
I know.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
Well, what's so fascinating is that, you know, we now have the technology to kind of pull all of this information together and say, wow,
yeah,
something else is happening here, and we don't know what it is. I want to also go into the Book of Enoch, because that fascinates me as well.
Yeah, the Book of Enoch is the ancient text that fills out a lot of these stories. In the Bible, for instance, it just says there were giants in those days. Well, it was Enoch who says how they got there. It's a fascinating story. We knew that there was a character named Enoch, and we knew that he had written because he's quoted in the Old Testament. If you go to the Begats in the Old Testament, so-and-so was born, and he lived for a certain number of years, and then he begat a son, and then he lived a certain number of years, and then he died. And one of the ones they mentioned was the great-grandfather of Noah. And his name was Enoch. So we know that there was a Book of Enoch because he was quoted in the Old Testament. The Old Testament writers must have read the Book of Enoch. He's also quoted in the New Testament in Jude 14. They talk about, Jude talks about Enoch. So the New Testament writers, whoever wrote the New Testament, they knew about the Book of Enoch, but nobody knew who it was. So the original authors of Genesis and Jude, they had to have known about this book because they quoted from it. But when it came time to put the Bible together, they didn't consider it worthy of inclusion. So it was destroyed. And that was it for almost 2,000 years until 1770, when James Bruce, who was an Englishman, he had a bit of thirst for adventure in him, and he visited Ethiopia for 3 years. And upon his return to England, he announced an astounding discovery. He had somehow obtained an old manuscript written in Ge'ez, which was the sacred language of Ethiopia, and it turned out to be a complete translation in Ge'ez of the long-lost Book of Enoch, purportedly written by Enoch himself. You say, how did it get to Ethiopia? Well, we go right back to that what we were talking about earlier. When the son of Solomon and Sheba went back to Ethiopia, when he took the Ark of the Covenant, did he possibly take the Book of Enoch too and other sacred texts? Because there they were down in Ethiopia, in Ethiopia. And so when we start to think about it, it gives us a picture of Enoch, who lived before Noah, before the alleged flood of Noah. And to be honest, he seems to be more like a shaman than a typical prophet. In the Book of Enoch, he was a dreamer. He had out-of-body experiences. He claimed to have been contacted by spirit entities who existed on foreign planes of existence. In what certainly seems like a shamanic vision, he was given an advanced warning that a deluge, a flood, was coming, which would destroy the world. And the reason for the flood is given in the Bible as well as the Book of Enoch. It was basically sexual in nature. God looked down and he saw that the sons of God had been mating with the daughters of men, and the Nephilim were born, the giants were born, and the product of that union disturbed God so much that he decided he needed to wipe out the humankind from the earth and start all over again. So when the flood came, strange thing in the Bible, it said, you know, it normally said that so-and-so lived and had a son and then he died. In Enoch's case, it said he did not die. He was taken one day. He just was taken. And Enoch's son was Methuselah, who lived 969 years, and Methuselah was going to be God's sign that the flood was not going to come as long as Methuselah was died. And if you do the math in the Old Testament, add them all up, Methuselah dies, according to the years given in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, he dies the very year the flood came. But the interesting thing is that Methuselah had a son named Lamech, and Lamech had a son named Noah. And when Noah was born, according to a fragment of text, the Genesis Apocryphon that comes from the book, Dead Sea Scrolls, when Lamech went in to look to his son Noah at the first time, he accused his wife, and according to the book of Enoch, of having an affair with one of these sons of God. In other words, he knew that the sons of God were mating with daughters of men, and he thought that his wife had an affair with one of these sons of God when he looked at his son. Why? Because his son not only glowed, but it was an immense stature. In other words, Noah was much bigger than normal kids. Now, if you want to take this literally, and I'm not sure we can, but I think it's fascinating to think about it, you know, Noah was God's do-over. You know, according to the Bible, God destroyed the whole world with the flood, and then he repopulated the whole world through Noah. But what does that tell us from the book of Enoch? It says that Noah was one of these Nephilim, that Noah was one of these giants. And if the whole earth was populated through Noah's offspring, what does that make you and I? We are offspring of a product of a union way, way back between the sons of God and the sons of men, or the daughters of men. Fascinating stuff,
well,
isn't it?
Now, the sons of God, were they angels?
Well, some people like to think they are, and other people like to think, well, maybe they're not. Maybe they were actually this lost civilization that seemed godlike because they had powers that were so much advanced over the other, you know, the hunters and gatherers who survived whatever, the deluge, or survived the, now it's popular to talk about the Younger Dryas comet that hit the earth, 12,000 uh-huh. years ago. So it's hard to say. But I'm just so struck by the fact that if the Bible stories that we read are all about mythological stories or metaphors to teach us something, why is there so much of this strange detail in them? You know, I find it fascinating. Enoch, for instance, I can go on and on about Enoch. I hate to just keep talking on and on, but I just find this stuff so fascinating. Enoch was also, traditions in Egypt and Arabia give Enoch the honor of being the one who invented writing. And he was also credited with giving the secrets of the art of building. And that's why, if any of our listeners belong to the Masonic organizations, they will be very familiar with the name Enoch, because Enoch figures prominently in Freemason traditions about ancient builders. And the story says that Enoch recorded all of his knowledge on a great stone tablet, on a great stone wall, or a message of some kind, and then he discovered that the earth was going to be destroyed in a great flood, so he buried the record, quote, in the bowels of the earth. Now, that's fascinating because Göbekli Tepe happened just at the time of the Younger Dryas and the great flooding that must have occurred to coastlines all over the world. And Göbekli Tepe, after it was built and used for a couple of centuries, it was deliberately buried. And so when Göbekli Tepe was buried, they said, was this built by Enoch, or in the Enochian tradition, as they say? Was this Göbekli Tepe built and then buried? Does it contain the secrets of Enoch that we need to know? No one knows. but Enoch is called Idris in the Islamic traditions, and he's called Hermes in the Greek traditions. Now, that makes Enoch, and Hermes, of course, was one of the gods in the pantheon of Zeus and all that. That makes Hermes, or Enoch, or Idris, same guy, that makes him reverenced in the Greek pantheon of gods, right up there with Zeus and Apollo and all the rest of them. So he's pretty fascinating character, and his book tells the story. They're all in the book about how he was taken up through the various layers of heaven, and he was shown the highest heaven, and and all this. So he certainly sounds like a very Old Testament shaman who had a out of body trip,
If he's compared or used the name Hermes, that brings to mind the fact that Thoth was called Hermes Trismegistus.
Yes, so three Thoth, names. Right.
And Hermes was one of the names that Thoth was called by.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It just sounds like what we're hearing in the Bible is a dim, or even in the Book of Enoch, is a dim recollection that was told orally for hundreds, maybe even thousands of years before it was finally written down. And we don't even have to say that Enoch was just one man who went and did all these things. He may have been part of a tradition, sometimes it's called the Enochian tradition. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating. Any of your listeners who want to get into the Book of Enoch, it's some tough going, because there's no modern translations that read easily, but it's really well worth studying. Fascinating stuff.
Well, that's another question I have, because some of them were some of these texts that were utilized were all written in different languages, and then theoretically translated into Latin and then into English, and there may have been other hopscotches in there too. So
you really
don't know the true source of the material. Do you know the source of the material in its original form? Is there somewhere where it says, this was in Hebrew and this was in Aramaic?
No, not really. We just assume that the Book of Enoch was written in Hebrew, but the only translation of it that we have was written in Ge'ez, the Ethiopian sacred language. That's the frustrating thing when people said Jesus said this or Jesus said that. It's the same kind of thing. Jesus, although he probably spoke Hebrew, because he would, that's people, but he that was not the language that he spoke day to day. He probably read Hebrew, but the language he spoke was Aramaic. And so the Aramaic that Jesus spoke was then at one point written down in Greek by the gospel writers. And so they would write these things in Greek. However, take the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. It's three chapters. It takes about 25 minutes to read it aloud, straight through. 25 minutes, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, to read it in English. Now, the book of Matthew was written some 60 years after Jesus died. How could somebody have possibly remembered word for word something that was said 60 years earlier and written it down, especially when the original sermon was given in Aramaic? They wrote it down into Greek, which was then translated into Latin, and from the Latin it's then translated into English in the King James Bible. That's pretty fantastic. So when everybody says, this is what Jesus said, because I say, well, how do you know that? Well, I know it because in my Bible it's written in red letters,
a congressman a long time ago that was talking, they were talking about the Bible, and I remember him, I remember the story of him saying, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. they were trying to change a language or something. But What I have never really understood is, and today there are Bibles that bring the speech down to a little more common vernacular, but the King James Version, it was written in High English so that even English people of the day couldn't understand it. So it's confusing to people. And I hate to say it, but the reading – level for most people. What newspapers are written on a seventh or eighth grade level, because
I think you're being generous. I think when you say seventh or eighth grade level, it used to be back in the 60s. I lived in Pleasantville, New York, which is the home of the Reader's Digest. And the Reader's Digest was written back in the 60s. It was written on a sixth grade reading level.
Okay. I lived in Amerenek, New York, so I
oh,
was
really?
Close to Pleasantville. Yes.
We used to play you guys in football.
Yes, you did.
Oh, Barbara, we're rivals and didn't even know it.
what a small world.
I wonder, because I was the drum major of our high school band, I wonder if you ever saw me march on the football field in our band.
Well, I was born in 44. You were born in 46?
Six.
Okay.
So we were just 2 years apart, you know.
I would have been
a sophomore when you were a senior.
It could have been.
Wouldn't
oh God,
that
what a
be
small
something?
World.
But if people have a hard time with Shakespeare, they will certainly have a harder time with the King James Bible. You know, I mean, it is different.
Oh,
and there are phrases that just don't make any sense anymore. For instance, the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts, you read the King James Bible, and the Apostle Paul is on his way up to arrest a bunch of, Christians and bring them back, and he meets the risen Christ, and he's knocked off, and he's made blind, and Jesus, the risen Christ, is said to have said to him, "Paul, Paul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard to kick against the pricks." What in heaven's name does that mean, right? And to be honest, I mean, there's ideas about what it means, but nobody knows what that means. We've forgotten what they could possibly mean by that. I've given a lot of sermons about that kind of thing, but what does that mean? You know, it's hard.
Well,
so,
that term has been used in slang for people who are not very nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right. I never even thought about that. Yeah. Boy. Okay. Well, I'll tell you, it's a fascinating study. You can see why I threw myself into censoring God so much, because I had to put all the stuff that we've been talking about between the covers of one book, and I could barely do it. I was under a word constraint by the author, by the publisher.
Oh, well, and what really is so mind-boggling is there's so much in the Bible that talks of even extraterrestrial stuff. And it's, why is it in there? I mean,
and
what gets me, I don't mean to be irreverent, but it's going to sound it. If this is the word of God, he needs a better editor.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Yeah, you know, when I read, I was a fundamentalist minister for many years, and so I would read the Bible literally. Marcus Borg, a great theologian, liberal theologian, wrote a book called Taking the Bible Seriously but Not Literally, and I loved that book, and it really does change your whole perspective of the Bible. But when I would read these things, I would read them all metaphorically. You know, when Ezekiel was having his, when he saw that great craft coming down, and it had wheels within wheels, and it was piloted by a person with the body of a man, but it had four different heads, the body of a man and an eagle and an ox, and I forgot what the other one was. So it was a hybrid piloting this thing, and it came down with a great roar and flame. And when you read that chapter, freed from the doctrinal, dogmatic stuff that most of us are taught in Sunday school, it's a perfect example of an Old Testament prophet having an extraterrestrial experience with a UFO. It's just perfect. Same thing with Isaiah. When I started having out-of-body experiences myself, I would go back and I would read some of these stories about the prophet Isaiah, for instance. Isaiah talks about in Isaiah chapter 1, it's a classic out-of-body experience. He's in the spirit, means he's meditating on the Lord's day, uh-huh, on a certain day. And all of a sudden he leaves his body and he's taken up to the highest heaven. And there he meets in another dimension, in another landscape. He meets this high being that is suffused in light. And it's surrounded by these hybrid creatures that are part human and part animal. And they're creating vibrations or making music. And he sees this thing, and there he receives a message. The being says, "Who shall I send? Who shall go for me?" And Isaiah said, "Here I am, send me." And Isaiah, uh-huh, comes back with the rest of the book of Isaiah. It's a classic shamanic journey. A shaman will go into a trance, and he will go have an out-of-body experience where he'll go to a different dimension. He will receive a message, and he will bring that message back to the tribe. It's a classic shamanic journey. And I think it's only our own tight-knit Christianity sometimes that says, let's, instead of opening our minds and accepting this stuff and saying, wow, what could be out there, we just say, oh, no, that can't be, because that's too pagan, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But the foundation of a lot of this is pagan. I mean, even mm-hmm, look at the holidays. I mean, the Romans put the holidays on pagan holidays too. Mm-hmm. And then when Christianity came over to Haiti, the Haitians took the names of the saints for their, yeah, for their spirit guides. I mean, it's
exactly.
It's,
yeah, if you go to Chartres Cathedral, one of the most beautiful cathedrals in the world today, Chartres Cathedral was built purposely right on the site that was the home place where the pagan people of Europe would meet. They were right there. I mean, in the center of the great groves where the Druids met. Chartres Cathedral, uh-huh, stands on the place where the Druids used to meet in their great sacred oak groves and carry on their religion. Christianity so often just baptized these things. I mean, tell me, what do fertility symbols like rabbits and eggs, what do they have to do with Easter? But they're there.
Yeah.
Or bringing an evergreen tree into your house, what does that have to do with the birth of Jesus? But the pagans did it. It was the Yule log and all that kind of thing. So, and they brought greenery into the house at the time of the winter solstice, and uh-huh, and all Christianity did was baptize these things. You're right. You're absolutely right.
It feels to me as though there's great wisdom here, and there's, mm-hmm, beautiful magic here, and a lot of the stories, even the story of Jesus, is,
yeah,
is reminiscent of some Greek
oh,
mythology,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, I did a matter of fact, I think it's up on my website, on my YouTube site. I did a YouTube video called "One Ring to Rule Them All," and I talked about how every single of the big five religions in the world today, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, every single one of those began with a prophet who had a vision, who was shamanic in nature. He had a new way of looking at the world, a new way of looking at God, a new way of seeing a connection between people and God. He had a vision, and he came back with that vision and developed a following, and then around that following grew the religions that we know today, and they're full of doctrine and dogma. And basically what they did was take that original beautiful vision and just standardize it and build walls around it, and us against them and all the rest. I think it's a tragedy. I really think it's a tragedy.
Well, you know, where is the true beauty of spirituality? Because I believe that spirituality is an extension of a belief system, which could be a religion. It's built upon that, but it goes further. so yeah. that, yeah. And I don't want, and I believe in God. I absolutely believe in God. But it seems to me that as humans, we have always looked for somebody to take care of us, so therefore we were looking for somebody more powerful that we could call upon to defend us. And the reality is all of us have that piece of God inside of ourselves. So
yeah.
So rather than praying to something out there, why not pray to that part of ourselves that has the power to help us solve anything?
In the book of Psalms and also in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark in the New Testament, Jesus is supposed to have said these words, "Know ye not that ye are God's?" And, you know, Jesus, if Jesus was the Son of God and calls us brothers and sisters, what does that make us? I really have come to believe that although in the religious world we like to say God made man in his own image, I honestly think that in most cases today, God has made man. I mean, man has made God in his own image. We have created a concept of God.
If God is a spirit, then God has no form.
Yeah, exactly. I love the Hindu tradition. The ancient rishis talked about the concept of Brahman and Atman. And they would talk about, you know, Brahman was the unknowable. You couldn't know Brahman. You couldn't describe Brahman. As soon as you tried to put Brahman in words, you've lost it. They used to say, the rishis used to say, Brahman is that which the tongue cannot soil. It was beyond human concept. But how do you conceive of a God like that? Well, they also had the idea of Atman, and the easiest way to understand Atman in English is probably the word soul. Atman is within. Atman is the heart, the soul of human beings. And then the great wisdom, I think, of the rishis, when they talked about Brahman and Atman, they would say, thou art that. That which is within us, the spirit or the soul which was in us, is one with that which cannot be described or cannot be touched by language. I like that concept. I really do. A lot of people would have troubles with it because they want to see something and they want to hold an image in their hand or something like that. But I think that's a human weakness, not a human strength. I really do.
No, I agree. Because we are a part of creation, and we were given free will. And that means that we have the freedom to make mistakes and to challenge ourselves with lessons and to learn from them and to grow. And certainly knowing that there is a source of all creation, the term God is too restrictive, so I'd rather call it divine.
I agree with you. Even as a minister, although granted I haven't been in a church for 10 years, except for 2 days ago I went and got a COVID shot in a church, but that was the first time I've been inside a church for 12 years. But even today, I know what I mean when I say God, and I'm perfectly comfortable with it, but I don't like to use the word in public or on the air very much because I just don't know what other people are going to be thinking when they hear me say God. The word God has so much baggage, doesn't it?
It does. And the Old Testament, God was not a nice guy. And
no.
If he created humanity or us in unconditional love and gave us free will, why did he try to destroy us?
Well,
I mean,
there you go. Now that
to me.
That brings us right back to the book of Genesis again. Everybody is so familiar with the story of Adam and Eve. But there's two major different ways of reading that story. And one of them has been censored by the Christian church. The message that got through, the message that was approved by Christianity, was that here's Adam and Eve, our first parents. They're in this perfect place. They're in the Garden of Eden. They have, they're one with each other. They're one with their environment. They're one with God. Unity. Everything is great, except for two rules. Don't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And there was the other one you're not supposed to eat either, but it was the tree of life, because if you ate the tree of life, you were going to live forever. Well, okay, we all know the story that is comes down to us through church and synagogue and mosque, and that's that Adam and Eve were going about doing their business, and Eve was by herself one day, and along comes a serpent. And the serpent starts tempting Eve and says, here, eat the apple. It wasn't an apple, but we'll just say eat the apple, because this is the fruit of the tree of good and evil. Now, what is good and evil? It's the tree of duality. And that is the world in which we live. We live in a world of duality, of up and down and hot and cold and good and evil and all the rest of that stuff. That's the material world. So Eve ate of the apple and gave it to Adam, and Adam ate of it. And all of a sudden God comes back and looks around and says, what have you done? You've eaten of the tree of duality. Now if you eat from the tree of life, you'll live forever. And that's what what the serpent tempted Eve. God knows that if you eat of the tree of good and evil, you will know all things, and if you eat of the tree, you will be as gods. And so we always consider the serpent evil. Well, there's a total different way of looking at that. The serpent has been given a bad rap over here in Western society. The serpent always considered evil and everything else. But in other mythologies, specifically in mythologies of Asia and even in the other places around the world, the serpent is a positive thing of India and everything else. The serpent is a very knowledgeable creature, and sometimes the serpent is even seen as a god. And so the other way of reading this was that, and now we go back into the Sumerian texts, which even predate the Bible. The Sumerian texts tell the story of the two half-brothers. One was Enlil, who was the bad guy, and the other was Enki, who was the good god. And Enlil, according to the Sumerian scriptures, wanted to enslave the human race. He wanted a slave of workers. He didn't want them with their head in the clouds and looking up into the spirit. He just wanted workers. And so when all of a sudden Enki saw what was going on, Enki and his brother, his sister, Nenki, decided they were going to offer humankind the gift of choice, the Sumerian legend says. So the serpent, who was really Nenki, the female goddess of wisdom, came down and offered human beings a choice, the choice of knowing good and evil. And then, so this was a good thing. And Eve took the choice and entered into the world of duality, entered into the world of experience. And according to the Sumerian texts, Enlil was just incensed. And he said, I don't want people doing this, because soon they might become gods themselves and live forever. So he cast us out of the Garden of Eden, and we were cast out into this material existence, where what have we done ever since then? We've had to work every day to earn our daily bread. Think about that when you go to your commute on Monday, right? We've had to work in the fields. We've had to do this. Now, even if the story is a metaphor, which I'm certain in one great sense it is, even if the story is a metaphor, it explains something that is totally different. The God of the Old Testament is this evil God who wants to destroy us and destroys the world with a flood and go into Canaan. The God who said don't commit murder now says to Moses, go into Canaan and kill all the Canaanites. This wasn't the good God. This wasn't the God who created the world and made everything good and said, lo, behold, everything is good. This was the evil God, Enki, and sometimes he's called the Demiurge. In other words, what this version of the Bible is saying is people who read it this way are saying the God that we think we're worshiping the God who created the world and made everything very good. No, that's not really the God, because history is always written by the winners. Enlil was the winner. He was the bad guy. And the God that we are really worshiping is none other than what Christians now call the devil. So it's a total different take, but it does explain why everything was so good and rosy in the beginning, and now there's so much evil in the world. And we have to earn our bread with the sweat of our brow and bring forth children in pain. And the serpent, which was the female goddess of wisdom, the serpent is to be cast underfoot and destroyed whenever we can. It may just be a metaphor, but, man, doesn't it explain a lot of history, huh?
It does, but I still don't like snakes.
No, okay, that's permissible.
I mean, thanks for the wisdom, but don't squiggle on my property, please, because, not where I want to go. But it does. I think that when my son and daughter-in-law, they're fundamental Christians, and
yeah.
And because of what I do, I have to say they have been so compassionate and so understanding and trying so much to understand my philosophy and what I do that I have to respect them greatly. They do not testify to me. They do not try to change my way of living. They really,
they're fabulous. To tell you the truth, I mean, the fundamental of the evangelical church was my home, too. And one of the reasons I wrote Censoring God is I hope that some of my old Christian friends, some of my old Christian parishioners, I hope they read it. I really do. Because people say, Jim, you're talking about all these different things. Didn't this destroy your faith? And to my way of thinking, no, it didn't destroy it at all. It made it so much deeper and so much wider and so much more open and acceptable.
Well, and not only that, But it gives you a broader sense of who the divine is.
Right.
The divine created the God that Christianity and everybody worships, and I think in a way, the fact that there's a source above that who's probably sitting and chuckling a lot. I mean,
I would think so. You know
look
how I like
what they're doing.
The way that the mental image that I like to have right now, and I'm certainly I don't want to throw this out and start a new religion or anything like that. I'm not trying to convert anybody to it. I just find this very helpful myself, because I'm very big on both left brain and right brain, both the intellect and the intuition, and I like to picture, I try to say, well, who are we? How did we get here? I like to picture a pie, something round, and then I take a slice out of that pie with a point end in the middle and then the outer crust out there. In the point, in the center, picture this pie, picture it whirling around and around and around in a circle, all the energy that's going around in a circle. But in the center, there's perfect peace. There's perfect stillness. There's perfect unity, oneness. Everything is the same. And you would say, why would anybody ever want to leave that? Well, because there's one thing we can't experience in that perfect peace of perfect center, and that's we cannot experience individuality. And I've almost come to be convinced that every single one of us at one time, that's our source of our being. We have always been in the source. It's eternal, and we cannot be separated from it. But in order to experience individuality, the great experience of individuality, we had a courageous decision to leave the source and to move out into the first area, which I like to call consciousness. Mm-hmm. We're not human beings yet, but we're aware of consciousness. This was the place that both Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking called the mind of God. And there in the mind of God, we can experience individual consciousness for the first time. But it's not sufficient. It hasn't taken us far enough. So we have to go through the first field of energy, and that field is what I like to call the Akashic field. The Akashic field is the place of all potential and all possibilities. And in that Akashic field, we begin finally to have an idea of individuality and how we can accomplish individuality. Now, Plato talked, or Socrates rather, talked about the idea of horse and horseness. He said a horse comes and goes, but horseness lasts forever. Horseness is the ideal, and a horse is only an expression of horseness. That's what you discover in the Akashic field. We're not individual people yet, but we have an idea of what a person can be. So we enter the second place of reality, what I like to call quantum reality. That's the place of thoughts and intuitions. Now we have some direction. Now we have an idea of what's happening. We're in that field of quantum reality, which we have just discovered through mathematics. But I think that shamans and gurus and rishis have been traveling that landscape for thousands of years in their minds. But we've just discovered it now through the magic of mathematics. And we know that we're all based in that field of quantum reality. That is the basis of all life. So how do we get from there out to the material, to the edge of the piece of pie? We have to go through the next field, and the next field is the newly developed Higgs field. When energy travels through the Higgs field, it, in effect, takes on mass. It slows down and takes on mass. So in the Higgs field, which was just developed within the last 20 years and just been proven through the Large Hadron Collider over in Europe, the Higgs field is that place through which we travel, and all of a sudden, quantum reality, which does not have mass yet, takes on mass as it goes through the Higgs field. Here in America, we talk about the Higgs field being like a field of molasses. It slows us down. In Europe, they're more apt to call it treacle. You go through a field of treacle, the European scientists. But when you enter into that through that Higgs field, all of a sudden, you enter into this last place where we live right now, the edge of the pie, the crust of the pie, material reality manifested. We have eaten of the apple. We have gone into the place of good and evil, the world of duality. I call it our perception realm. We're blocked off by our five senses, which let in certain impressions but not others. For instance, we know our senses tell us that there is red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. We know there's light that vibrates a lot faster than that, but we just can't see it, microwaves, for instance. We know that there's a light that vibrates slower, but we can't see that either. So our senses take a slice of that reality and say, this is all you can handle. Same thing with sound. My dog hears sounds and smells that I can't, comprehend. But out here in this reality, now we can do something that we left the source for. This is a school. We can experience individuality. We can experience what it is to be outside of oneness, outside of unity. We've left the Garden of Eden, so to speak. We now know what it's like to be an individual apart from God, apart from each other. Now, the good side of that is that that's what we came out here to experience. The bad thing is that it can make us feel very alone sometimes. And we can feel cut off from our friends, cut off from other people, cut off from our environment, cut off from God, cut off. Well, that's the price we have to pay. That's why I said it was such a courageous decision for us to make. But out here in this material reality, in this perception realm, we go through our lives and we experience good and bad. We experience health and we experience pandemics. We experience peace and war, all of the good and the bad, the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. Mm-hmm. But when we die, it's only our material body that dies. We make our way back to the source and we carry all of this wisdom that we got out here in school. We carry it all back with us, and we re-enter the source. So what happens to the source? It gets larger. It has an experience now that it could never have before. And our material is pooled, so to speak. Our wisdom is pooled. In effect, we come from God, and we take back to God that which we have experienced. And in that sense, we really are God out here in the world experiencing something that we could never have experienced there in the source, that place of perfect peace.
I don't know if it's true, but it helps me.
It helps me. Whatever.
I agree totally, totally with your whole process up to the very last. I believe that we separated to grow, to gather, to learn, to experience all of your different fields, you know. But ultimately, I believe that the spark within us grows with each incarnation, so that ultimately we become a source of creation and send out seeds ourselves.
Yeah. I love that. That's wonderful. Yeah, yeah. Boy, I can just hear the words of Jesus. Know ye not that ye are gods? You know, ye are the source.
Why would we have to return to a source of everything that knows everything?
Exactly. Yeah.
I think we've been sent out to become a source ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Not next lifetime, you know, maybe a few more. But it makes sense to me that if that the source is seeding eternity.
Oh, I love that thought. That's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah.
So that we as seeds eventually will become creators ourselves to seed another dimension, another universe, another realm, another whatever. But it makes sense that it's sending out seeds or missionaries or whatever, and that our responsibility is to grow and become as good as we can each lifetime and take each experience and build it so that the spirit within us becomes larger and larger and larger. And at some point, I think that spirit that was in Jesus and Buddha and Krishna and everything, we're on their same journeys too.
That's wonderful. I love that thought. Just like you're kind of a spiritual multiverse, you know, all these different universes existing, seated at the beginning. That's fascinating. So and the Big Bang, which starts all these different universes, and the big spiritual bang, which starts all these different seeds, which go out into infinity and seeds infinity. That's a pretty heavy thought. It really is, Barbara. I love it.
Yeah, and it doesn't deny that there are spiritual people who come into this dimension for the purpose of sharing wisdom, but they're on their journey too. And they're so much more evolved than we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't appreciate them, so we kill them.
Yeah. That's right. We crucify them. You know, when you come right down to it, when people say sometimes, well, this is just, you know, pie in the sky thinking, and how does that help me in my daily life? If you're facing a pandemic, if you're facing evil, if you're facing a war, if you're facing something like that, isn't it practical to think that one of your jobs is to face this, even though it's bad, even though it's evil, even though it hurts?
Absolutely.
That's why you came out here. Now, to me, that would help people get through tough times. That's pretty practical. That's not just a wild, you know, spiritual thought. That's a very practical reason for learning about this stuff, I think.
And then that old saying, you know, you're never given more than you can handle, is true.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, sometimes you're overwhelmed and you have to have a couple of, you know, woe is me days. But you do handle it. And the fact that you are capable of doing it, and you have within you the creative strength to solve whatever it is that you're facing, I mean, it's important to realize that the struggles that you get are actually something that you've invited into your life so you can grow.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, don't be so ambitious next time.
Don't check
all the boxes.
Yeah, you know, even when people were facing something horrible like the Holocaust, and when they were marched off to the concentration camps, the ones who made it, even in the midst of all that evil, were the ones who were able to say, "I can do this. I, you know, this happened for a purpose, even though it's terrible. It sounds terrible, but it would give you strength to go through it.
Yes.
So that's a pretty practical thing.
Look at what happened with 9/11. I believe, first of all, it was a tragedy. It was horrible. But when it happened, I lived in Mamaroneck, and we could see the smoke, and there were ashes.
From Mamaroneck, huh? Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we were right on the water. So
I was way over in New England then, so I didn't see it.
So what I saw was, it was an incredible sacrifice, and yet those spirits on some level volunteered to be, they knew spiritually that they were becoming a symbol for something for all of humanity.
Yeah.
I saw a celebration of lights going up in the clouds.
Yeah, yeah. And if people say, if they're tempted to look at this and say, how can you make good out of tragedy? And my way of thinking is, if you don't make good out of tragedy, then tragedy wins, you know?
Yeah.
So we have to. It's one of the things we have to do.
Look at all the people that lose children and then turn it into an amazing journey of helping children who have disabilities or whatever because they've lost a child to that disease or something.
Yeah,
I mean, if you lose a child, it's devastating. I can't imagine it. I don't want to even think about it. But if you take that experience and you take that pain and you say, how can I help humanity? How can I take this experience and help other people who are going through maybe the same thing? How can I learn from this, grow from this, and help other people heal from this? Then you've taken that step beyond the pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the pain's still there, of course. But,
sure.
You do something.
My wife recently lost her son up in New England. And he died. And then she was faced with this big thing. How do I get up there, to do some kind of a memorial service for him? And she had to – it was in the middle of a pandemic. What do you do? So she had to wait month after month after month. And he was cremated, and she finally decided, I just have to do this. And when the shots became available, she got her shots so she could fly. And she went up there not knowing what was going to happen. It was up on Martha's Vineyard, and she hadn't lived there for years. She went up there and just passed the word around. The word just got passed around that we're going to have not a funeral service. We're going to have a celebration of life for this, man who lived here on Martha's Vineyard. And the parking lot was jam-packed with people. One of his good friends was a police officer, and he said, I'm just going to wander around out here because I don't want to be the one to run you all in because they were having this great gathering, And person after person came up and completely unplanned and took some of his ashes and put them out in the ocean that he loved so much and told a story. And so many people came up to her afterwards, and they said, and Barb just went up there. She thought maybe there might be, a couple of dozen relatives or something at the most. And all these people from all over the island came, and they kept on saying the same thing to her. We are so glad you did this. She did it on his birthday, which happened to be St. Patrick's Day. And so here is this great, instead of a tragedy, Adam is gone, it was a great celebration of who he was and how he changed our lives. And he entered into the hearts of every single person who was there that day. And it turned into what would have been a tragedy into a very beautiful testimony of faith and strength and memory and hope. And that's the kind of thing that can happen. I really believe it.
Yeah, and it's those moments that unite us. And
I think
the fact that we've been so isolated that people are beginning to unite in a safe way you know, yep. more and more. I mean, mm-hmm. yes, there's bad stuff going on, but you know something, there's always going to be bad stuff going on. And if you have yep. peace and love in your heart, that's what surrounds you.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. I really do feel for people who say, but Jim, we're out here. How come I don't know this? How come I don't feel this? Well, because that act of moving out from the source into individuality carries with it the idea that if we knew all this stuff, I mean, if it was imprinted in our heart, and we didn't just believe it, but we knew it, it wouldn't have the proper teaching for us. The only way to do it is to actually experience it. The only way to experience individuality is sometimes to be alone. The only way to experience the joy of life is sometimes to go through the tragedy too. And if we understood it, then it wouldn't be the same. They used to have this conversation about Jesus on the cross. The priest used to argue back and forth. Did Jesus know he was divine? Did Jesus know that he was going to get through the cross? And some of the priests would say, yes, he must have, because he was the Son of God, the whole Trinitarian thing in Christianity. And the other priests would argue, no, because if he had actually known it, then it wouldn't have made the cross so terribly painful and meaningful. You know, the only way he could do it was to face it as a human, and that meant do it on faith, not by uh-huh. sight, you know. And so I've grown to really have a great appreciation for the idea of living our lives by faith. And it was strange, because I thought I was doing it when I was younger, and then I gave it up when I kind of was in that weird section of turning away from Christianity. But now I find myself coming back with a whole new appreciation of what faith is. And it really empowers me. I think it'll empower all of our lives. I really do.
Yeah, it's not so much believing as it's knowing.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a sneaking suspicion that when this body dies, the first thing we're going to do is wake up and we're going to say, I knew it.
My late husband and I he was a biblical theologian, and mm-hmm. he did not believe in reincarnation, and I do. And mm-hmm. finally, you know, we would go round and round and round and round, and I finally said to him, I tell you what, only way we're going to solve this. First one who dies comes back and tells the other who was right. So I have not heard from him, so I assume I'm right, because he is the kind that would never come back and tell me, you know, you were right. Never happened.
Well, you know, when I was a fundamentalist and an evangelical Christian myself, predestination was considered of the devil and all that kind of stuff. But now when I read the Bible, I can find there's plenty of room in Christianity and in Judaism, I think also. I think even in Islam, if you know, people really want to study it, I think there's plenty of room uh-huh. for reincarnation. I really do. I have personally come to believe in it myself, as you do. Sometimes I wonder about this whole nature of time thing. I don't know if we live our lives one after another, or if we live lives in all separate times at the same time. We are experiencing life here, but in perhaps another dimension we are there, we're experiencing life in the past or in the future or whatever. I don't know how that all works, and I don't really need to know, but I don't think there's any problem at all with
the creation, you know, of a human spirit is
yeah.
much too complex for a one-shot deal.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%. Yeah. I've even had a couple of out-of-body experiences in which four different times now I've had the opportunity of finding somebody who died confused and uh-huh. Didn't know where they were, sometimes for long periods of what we would call time, but for them, of course, time doesn't exist. And I've actually had the blessing of helping them on toward the light. It's called the work of the psychopomp, and I've been really blessed by this. Up at Monroe Institute, where I studied for a week with William Buhlman, they have a special group up there who just majors in this. They study this stuff and they do it. And they've been able to actually meet people who have died. And then when they come back with a name, with a place, and they've actually been able to look them up and find them in the historical record, find them in the records of the town where they lived and that kind of thing. I had that opportunity once. And it was a absolutely unbelievable experience to come up with a name and to come up with a town and to come up with a street and then Google that and find the place where I was. It's just wonderful. Wonderful.
I've had a number of people from the Monroe Institute on the show.
Yeah.
And they have it's remarkable the work that they can do.
Oh, they're doing tremendous work up there. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I've done some out of body work too and remote viewing for sure. And I think that's the one thing about this metaphysical field. In my mind, a lot of people become a psychic and they stop growing and they sit with being a psychic and they're happy. And, you know, I've always said there has to be something more. And I served in the pulpit for 5 years in a spiritualist church and never thought I would do that.
Yeah.
Put everyone to sleep the first time I gave a sermon.
and now you're talking
I
for 2 hours. Now you're talking for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Broadcast around the world. So.
yeah. Well, this is many, many decades later. but it's amazing.
It's all part of our growth, isn't it? It really is.
It is.
And I think there's a danger of being locked in. We started this whole conversation talking about the scriptures and how to read the scriptures. And we had mentioned the fact that, you know, doctrines and dogmas can really lock us in. I think we sometimes have to break through those doctrines and dogmas. I had an experience the other day. You know, history is often hidden in texts that people pluck out of the scriptures to support what they already believe. I was studying a thing recently about the Civil War, and I was wondering what it would have been like on the Sunday before the Civil War. I live in South Carolina, so on the Sunday before South Carolina began the Civil War, you know, by bombing the fort. And I pictured in my mind two different preachers in two different churches, one down here in South Carolina and one up north in New England, say, where I used to live, on the Sunday before the Civil War. And the preacher down here in South Carolina picked out his passage for the day was going to be from the book of Ephesians that said, "Slaves, obey your masters." And on that text, that's right there in the book of Ephesians, "Slaves, obey your masters." And on that text, everybody was saying, "See, it's the will of God that slavery is in the world today. We have to defend it because it's God's will." Meanwhile, up in New England, there's another preacher, and he picked for his text that day the text from Galatians that says, "There is no more slave or free, for we are all one in Christ." And his congregation all said, "See, the Word of God says, the Bible says, that slavery is wrong. We got to get rid of it." And then the Civil War began, and 258,000 people in that war died believing in their wholeheartedly in Ephesians, and 3,600 died believing. 36,000 people died believing in Galatians, that we are all free in Christ. Both groups of people died for their belief in the Bible, and both of them were totally right with their belief and totally, absolutely, totally wrong with their belief. The Bible said both things, and so what does that mean? That we just have to get rid of the Bible? No, it means that we got to compare these things and say, what is the wisdom that we're trying to get at here? And the fact that, like I say, the Bible comes to us through a committee, and it's really hard. But I think for those people who might be listening to our conversation today and saying, that's not what I believe about the Bible, I have to ask you the first question I always ask people when they say that. Have you read the Bible straight through from cover to cover? That's the first thing. And it's really not that difficult. There's all kinds of English translations that make it very readable. And that's the first thing. If you're going to swear by a book or swear at a book or if you're going to swear on a book, for heaven's sake, read it. If you're going to call it the Word of God, what can be more important in the world than to say, if this is the Word of God and I haven't even read it, man, what does that make me? And yet I'm absolutely convinced that if we just do it with an open mind and really read and meditate and think, there's going to be parts that are going to make us mad. There are going to be parts that are going to make us happy. There are going to be parts that will bring great insight, and there are going to be parts that we're saying, that's just plain stupid. I say it the Bible, but you can do the same thing with the Quran. You can do the same thing with Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. You can do the same thing with the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, with the wisdom of the Buddha. So it's all there.
I do have one question with these committees or councils or whatever they were called.
Yeah.
How many women were on them?
None. There is some evidence that perhaps in the Gnostic tradition in Egypt that there may have been women more involved. But in Roman Christianity and in Orthodox Christianity, none. None at all. Which was probably why Mary Magdalene was buried so much. I mean, she's dangerous. If she turned out to be the disciple who Jesus loved, and when some of the disciples say in the Gospel of Thomas, for instance, that Jesus loves you more than us, and they're talking to a disciple, we don't know which one, but the suspicion is that they were talking about Jesus loved Mary Magdalene more than he did the other disciples, perhaps because they were a couple. I just don't know. But we have lost a lot, because not only were there no women in the original councils and the committee, but down through history, women have just not been allowed to make real contributions to Christianity, to Judaism, to Islam, totally killed the whole religion.
It seems to me, since it took a man and a woman to create humanity, then there should be a balance in the records that were kept and have been brought forward in time to guide humanity.
One would think. It would be a different world. I'm feeling the same way in American history. I can't wait to have our first woman president. I guarantee it's going to change the way the country works. And I can say that because look at what Margaret Thatcher did in England.
Yeah.
And look what Golda Meir did in Israel. History itself tells us that when women are not just allowed, but women are followed, it makes a total, total difference in the way we view the world and what happens.
It does. And on that, I have to tell you that we're out of time.
Well, this has gone by quickly.
It's gone by very quickly, and I thank you so very much for sticking with me and getting the show finally done.
The audience doesn't realize this was our third try. We ran into technical problems. So
all over the place, but we
but
got
we did it
done.
But
and,
we did
and
it.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to have you back on again because I'm going to read more of your books. So we'll have you back on.
Oh, I hope so.
And,
I hope so.
And we will certainly see you on Mark's show shortly. I think it's next week or the week after.
Next week. Next Tuesday, Yeah.
Okay, so looking forward to that as well. So thank you again for being so much there for me to do it three times.
Well, thank you. I sure appreciate it. Good talking with you, Barbara, as always.
And to you as well. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Certainly appreciate your joining us. Check us out on YouTube and on Rumble. And if you like what you're hearing and seeing and learning, please make sure to subscribe. That's the only way we really know you're listening. So I would really appreciate it if you do that. That's it. Good night. Have a great one. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay happy, and stay wise.